Antonio X with Commander Q.
36
X
with Commander
Q. 36 X with Commander Q.
Water. It's about 11:15 p.m. I'm at a bar called Governor's Place downtown. And since none of my other plans have worked out, I've decided that I'm going to drink for the next 5 hours. So this is the first of those bars. It's a sucky bar, but it's a start. At least I'm into something now. All right. On the TV, there's this baseball game. Cubs and White Sox. 13 innings, and it's still tied at 5-5. Pretty funny. Top of the 14th. What a long game. Take a picture here. Take this down on all sides. What can I say that is useful? All the draft beer they have is over $4 a pint. Bad.
What we'd like to do, what we would like to do is sing a song together. Now you see what usually happens is you get a group of people that might sing, and for some reasons that are not unknown anymore, they won't do it. Most of us need approval. Most of us need to get approval from our neighbors before we can actually let it all hang down. Now what is happening here is we're going to try to do a sing-along. Now a lot of people don't like to do it because they feel that it might be old-fashioned. But you must dig that it is not a fashion in the first place. It is a feeling. And if it was good in the past, it's still good. We would like to sing a song called Higher, and if we could get everybody to join in, we'd appreciate it. Everybody's grooving and can on. Wanna take you higher, higher. What I'd like you to do is say higher and throw the peace sign up, it'll do you no harm. Still again, some people feel that they shouldn't, because there are situations where you need approval to get in on something that could do you some good. Yeah. Now, if you throw the peace sign up and say higher, get everybody to do it. There's a whole lot of people here, and a whole lot of people might not want to do it because if they can somehow get around it, they feel that there are enough people to make up for it. And on, et cetera, et cetera. Ah. We're going to try higher again. If we get everybody to join it, we'd appreciate it. It'll do you no harm. Wanna dig it higher? Let's try one, y'all. Wanna dig it higher, higher.
Carmen's near Division Street. Darker, better bar. Not perfect, but better. Guinness cheaper. Oh, I'm so happy that the dead just came out. That's
Swiss Commander Q.
36 Jesuífe Commander Q.
The cold and sunshine, daydream. Walk you in the darkness, blowing like the wind does. Blooming, blooming like a red rose. We're never gonna find you.
something you just can't tell. Something they will and some they won't. Some it's just as well. You can laugh at my behavior, and that'll never bother me. Say the devil is my savior, but I don't pay no heed. And I will go out shining, you shine a light from you. I'll never look behind me, my troubles will be few.
I was at 5 years ago, and no cartoons on the screen, and I couldn't really get a beer. That's too bad. I think it's
X-Wiz Commander Q.
36 Jesuífe Commander Q.
Commander Q.
Um spirit, no radio, no podcast, one against the world.
36 X with Commander Q.
Radio.com.
Ah!
So it's, I guess 4 a.m., I'm not really sure. I'm sitting on a sidewalk at the corner of West Division Street and North LaSalle Boulevard. I just got some food from a place called Mr. Gyro's nearby. Chicago certainly has good food and good architecture. And while standing in the little place waiting for my food, I got talking to a guy who was with a couple of women, who was with his friend. He was like, "Why do we put up with women?" And I said, "You know why?" And he's like, "Well, yeah, you're right, but I still don't know why." Seemed to want to bust out of his own situation, if only for a couple of minutes, and that was cool. I guess I struck him as different. Oh, I was doing it the first time. There is a bed waiting for me. At the hostel. But I fight the desire for sleep. This night to mean something, and I even ended up at old school places, Demon Dogs, Division Street. I have changed. Those places haven't changed. That's what tonight has told me. It's more than just the muddled circumstances under which I came here. Not who I was. I guess you can't go back and make a city seem new. Excuse me. I couldn't even go on a decent drink tonight. So anyway, it's all foolishness. I take shit way too seriously. I don't know how to be other than what I am. I've got to get to the Art Institute tomorrow. Go to that place tomorrow at night, Martyrs. I don't want to get my hopes up about meeting Karma or anybody else. It'll probably go bad in some way or other. I've got to get to sleep. Cabs going by all the time and I'm not hailing them yet. Probably not even that far from where I need to get to. I'm so fucking tired. I'm gonna snap a photo and right, maybe, and then surrender and get a cab. Till tomorrow, peace out. It's Saturday, June 10th, 2000, I'm guessing about noontime. While I'm washed up, I'm wearing shorts today. I'm wearing my Blackfish t-shirt. Clean. I've met, I think everybody is staying in this room currently. I think they'll be English. Yeah, so I'm ready to go. I'm definitely ready to go. I think I'm going to go to Demon Dogs again. There's something reassuring about that place. It's familiar, and I like their food. Today's going to be a better day, one way or another. It's going to be a better day. I'm going to make it a better day. I didn't sleep that much last night. They all started stirring this morning about 9, but I had ignored it up to a certain point. I think I must have gotten 4 hours of sleep. But I slept a lot yesterday during the day, so I bulked up in advance, so to speak. So, today is about going to the museum. And I hope meeting up with Jeff from Madison. But that may or may not happen, so I'm not gonna get too crazy hopeful about it. I don't know whether I'd be more disappointed if he comes or not. I mean, if he comes, there's getting him a bed and all. That may suck. It may not. You'd be alright. But just getting in touch with him is going to be annoying. And then tonight, karma. I don't know about that either. And I've thought about not going to Martyrs. I've thought about going to this coffee house and gallery that's having a reading, jazz and poetry. Sounds like it could be cool. So, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do. I'd like to tell her, come with me. Come with me to something different. She says she writes. This might be cool. I can see music back in Boston, but chances to do poetry. I just need to be involved with something that involves talking to people, and I know that being at a show is mostly about dancing, and it's not really that social, so, and it's not that participatory either. Yeah, so that's like my thinking at this point, that I may just not go to Martyrs. Alright, I've got to get going. I've got to find out what time it is. I've got to see if I can get hold of this Jeff kid, and I've got to get some food. So, more later. It's about 4 o'clock. Art Institute of Chicago, lower level. I'm sitting in an armchair outside the men's room, trying to figure out my next step. There's so many paintings here that it would be great to write poems off of. But the museum closes in an hour. Pleasure.
36X with Commander Q.
36X with Commander Q.
36X with Commander Q.
36X
with Commander Q. Spirit Long Radio. Long Radio. Podcast. Podcast. The world.
36X with Commander Q.
Long Radio. Long Radio. 36X with Commander Q. Long Radio.
This is Charles Jordan here in Williston, Vermont. It is August 15th, 1969.
The low in the 60s. Right now the winds are southerly at 7 miles an hour. Temperatures northwest 77, southwest 77. Downtown in Marina City it's 81 degrees. Jim Frank, WCFL News.
Somebody else has another idea about what's best for me.
Well, that's not the kind of person that you like. Now, that's an understandable, predictable response. We all respond that way. We tend to gravitate towards people who agree with us. That's natural.
I'm not talking about whether or not I agree or disagree with them. I'm talking about the type of where they've gone in life. Many of these men that I've run into are much...
Office is open from 10 a.m. until 10 p.m. daily, and tickets are also available at ticket agencies. Now, coming Thursday, August 21, one of the great English blues groups, Led Zeppelin. That's August 21st, the Led Zeppelin of the Carousel. But right now, be sure to catch Johnny Mathis and a great show, including the Bossarillo, now through Saturday at the Carousel Theater in Framingham. August 15 and 16, Linda Ronstadt, Jim Buckley, Dr. John the Night Tripper, the super heavy sound will be at the Aragon Ballroom Friday and Saturday, August 15 and 16. Also by the air-conditioned Aragon. Oh, yeah. And only the Aragon Ballroom features for those over 21. One favorite aid dial, three. With the Aragon Ballroom, 1106 West Lawrence, LO18323. Doors open 8 to 2 a.m. Coming to the Aragon August 23rd, Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, Merle Haggard, and August 29, 30, 31, Jerry Lee Lewis, Wayne Cocker, and the DC Rider. Hey! Advance tickets at Aragon Box Office, all 42 TRS outlets.
Stay tuned for The Shadow at the Tone on the Raw Britain Camp Radio Network.
And welcome to Melody Ranch with Gene Autry.
I'm back in the saddle again. I'll play a thrill with a thrill.
I shall be much in years ere I again behold my Romeo.
I will omit no opportunity to beckon thee my greetings, love to thee.
Queen, so we can never meet again.
I doubt it not. And all these words shall serve to fight these hoaxes in our time to come. Farewell. One kiss and not this end.
Double.
You got it backwards there, Jim. It's a long journey from home to the Jamboree this Saturday night. That's where all the appearances, along with a whole stack of other fine folks. You're listening to the Gus Thomas Show. And the temperature in Wheeling is 70 degrees right now.
And now we come to the end of the hour.
And of course, while you're out looking for your sugar, somebody's going to come in and steal your honey. Most likely Dan Nevers, because he goes around looking in windows, you know.
McLaren Lounge, Transit Road near Bay, proudly present Bob Chappelle and the Holden People, featuring Bobby Nelson, direct from the Riviera in Las Vegas and the Sheraton in Puerto Rico, to the elegant McLaren Lounge, Transit Road near Bay.
In baseball last night in the National League, we saw Buffalo down Toledo by a score of 10-3. Steve Mitchell here, the KB spot in Buffalo. Right through those 6 o'clock on a Friday morning. Philadelphia. Got the intrigues, kid. I've got 6 minutes before 2 o'clock. What have you got? 66 degrees. It's a Friday morning in WJLY. We've got good music on the way. I can't say one thing about this show. I play more music than anybody else around. Gene Pitney now, he's playing Games of Love.
This is WFPA Action Line News. I'm Chuck Edwards reporting for the Department of Public Affairs.
At that time. We have three for Joe, Jerry, and Philip, Steve Frederick, wishing you all a good evening and a good morning, and please, work for peace.
And controversy, New England's number one rated town meeting of the year. We invite you to join us nightly for the Steve Frederick Show. The views and opinions expressed on the preceding program do not necessarily constitute the views and opinions of the new WMEX, its management, or its sponsors. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning.
WMEX 15K.
I'm not afraid to
Station, 1369 Elm Street, Manchester, opposite the ASB, features 24-hour phone service. Open daily, 8 a.m. to 9 p.m., Saturday, 8 to 5. For service, call AMCO at 627-3868.
That number again for you to call is 627-3868. I think it's raining outside.
We've got our derelict check. It looks at 2. Hasn't checked in. Well, he checked in by way of freeway, but that's not officially checking in until he actually calls on the phone. But to my surprise, derelict 1, Bobby Owen, as the greasy, has me on a greasy shelf. I think it's any movie tonight. I'm just like talking through a greasy radio. I wonder if I'm going to clear my throat. Nate dances a lot when he makes the donuts, right? Goes around cutting the donuts like that, you know. And knocks the radio out of whack, especially when he dances. Bob, don't do that. All right. Here come the Dells and over the night. 70 degrees outside. Now the partly cloudy skies. Winds southwest 7 miles per hour. That relative humidity at 68%. Kind of chilly out tonight.
Strokes an hour on an O29 sequence. Computer programming center will help to place you in a really good job, too. Tuesday or evening classes. CBC is a state-approved school. Waiting loads are available. And you'll be going to school with people you like at a safe, out-of-the-loop location. Call Jack Mitchell at 725-881 right now. At 725-881. Make a big difference in your little life, love.
Chicago weather.
We'll have a little fair sky activity going on through Saturday overnight, 70 and a high tomorrow, near 85 degrees on a Friday under fair skies in the Windy City. I.E. Chris Stevens. 75 degrees at WLS.
Solid Marina City at 78 degrees. Jim Frank, WCFLU. Don't forget, the action line opens in just about 13 minutes from now. 222-1650. Gary S. from Cindy, Marla to Frank, Bucky to Patty, and also Mary Lou to Stan, and Gary Novak. Mary Ray loves you. Where you'll always find an informal atmosphere and great bands playing the rock and soul music you want to hear.
So, from that day on, it's been me and old Giddy Up Go. I've made a lot of friends at all the truck stops, and some of them would kid me about my little sign. Of course, they knew where I got the name, because I told them about that little boy of mine. And his first word about the truck was, "Giddy up, go." Beside me pulled a brand new diesel rig, both stacks blowing black coal. And as he pulled around and back in front of me, a big lump came in my throat. A little sign on the back of the truck that read, "Giddy up, go." Well, I pushed old Giddy up and stayed right on him until the next truck stop where he pulled up. I waited till he went in and I offered to buy him a cup. Well, we got to talking shop and I said, "How did you come by the name on your truck, Giddy Up Go?" Well, he said, "I got it from my pop. Dad used to drive a truck. That's what Mom talked about a lot. You see, I lost Mom when I was just past 16. And I lost all track of Pop. Mom said he got the name from me. I shook his hand and told him that I had something I wanted him to see. I took him out to the old truck and brushed off some of the dirt so the name would show. And his eyes got big and bright as he read the Giddy Up Go. Well, we had a lot of things to talk about, and buddy, I felt like a king. And now we've just pulled back on old 66, and he handled that rig better than any gear jammer that I've ever seen. Well, now the lines on the highway have got a much brighter glow as we go roaring down the road, and we stare at that little sign that reads, Giddy Up, Go.
Information on what you believe will become news, call WIP's hotline. Just dial the letters HOTLINE, hotline. You could be the next winner of WIP's weekly news tip award of $25.
Providence, it's 228
at the news time. Chicago weather, great. Fair through Saturday. Quincy has 73 degrees. WLS lakefront temperature 78. O'Hare reports 74 degrees. And officially Midway has 75 degrees. John McLaren reporting for the big 89.
Swiss Commander Q.
36
Jesuit
Commander Q. following program is from NET.
He stood there, alone on the stage, with one hand up in the air, and he was a perfect target. And a man, police say he was Thomas Hagen, ran down the aisle with a shotgun, and the ones with him were already shooting, when the shotgun was right in front of Malcolm X, and both barrels raked him. Malcolm went straight back, and the sound of his head slamming onto the wooden floor was mixed with the screams, and he lay on his back on the stage of an old ballroom. It has been 7 years since Malcolm X was assassinated on a bare stage in New York's Audubon Ballroom in front of 400 witnesses. Shortly afterwards, three men were brought to trial and found guilty of the murder. But circumstances surrounding the trial, the assassination itself, accounts in the press, and subsequent actions were so peculiar that 7 years hence, the question of who killed Malcolm is still with us, although three men have been convicted of his murder. We must ask the larger question, why was he murdered? What power structure felt so threatened by the words of this one man? There were at different times in his life three Malcolms living under separate names and philosophies, Malcolm Little, Malcolm X, and El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. To fully understand the threat that Malcolm posed, one must understand his evolution. He was born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska, May 19, 1925, the seventh of nine children. His father, a staunch follower of Marcus Garvey, was found dead. Allegedly, he was killed because of his involvement in black nationalism. Malcolm was 6 years old. At age 15, after completing the eighth grade, Malcolm quit school and moved to Boston to live with an older sister. He eventually made his way to New York, where he was known as Big Red, and worked as a pimp, waiter, numbers man, and dope peddler. In 1946, when he was 20 years old, he was arrested and sentenced to 10 years imprisonment for armed robbery. While in prison, he was converted into the Muslim religion and became Malcolm X. When paroled in 1952, after serving 6 years, he was a devout follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. His first assignment was to set up a Muslim mosque in Detroit. In 1953, Malcolm went to Chicago to live and be trained by Mr. Muhammad himself. A year later, he was sent to Harlem to establish Mosque No. 7. An excellent debater and orator, Malcolm X became the verbal whip of Mr. Muhammad and the Muslims.
Well, sir, if we have sat around here for the past 100 years begging all of the white political hypocrites and every president that has taken office for some kind of freedom or some kind of justice and some kind of equality, and we today yet don't have it, then I think you can easily see that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is right when he says that the only way the black man can be free is when he has a land of his own and a government of his own and an economy of his own, an industry of his own, so he can do the things for himself that he now is waiting and begging the white man to do for him and never gets done.
No matter what happens, we don't teach you to turn the other cheek. We don't teach you to turn the other cheek in the South, and we don't teach you to turn the other cheek in the North. We teach you to obey the law. We teach you to carry yourselves in a respectable way. But at the same time, we teach you that anyone who puts his hand on you, do your best to see that he doesn't put it on anybody else. You don't have any boats or airplanes bringing drugs into this country. The white man brings it in. The white man brings it to Harlem. The white man makes you a drug addict. The white man then puts you in jail when he catches you using drugs. Who is it that controls the prostitution in Harlem? It's the white man. Who controls the large sale of whiskey and wine? It's the white man. You don't have any distillery. You don't own Shenley's. You don't own Old Overholt or Seagram. You don't put the seal on that bottle of whiskey. It's the white man. Who gives you the deck of cards and the dice that you use to gamble with? It's the white man. And after he sell them to you, he catch you with them and put you in jail for using them.
Malcolm warned against the drug threat long before it had become a popular issue, because he preached separatism at a time when most blacks pursued integration. Malcolm was not fully appreciated by most blacks during his lifetime. He was often branded a, quote, radical militant because of his outspoken attitude toward whites.
When the Honorable Elijah Muhammad finishes opening your and my eyes and making it possible for us to see this white man like he really is, he don't have to worry about us integrating with him. We don't want to be around that old pale thing. We don't want to be around that old pale thing. We don't want to integrate with that old pale thing. We don't want to sleep next to that old pale thing. No, we can do without him. You find that old pale thing laying out in the sun, trying to get to look like you. That old pale thing. Find him using man tan, trying to look like you. That old pale thing. That old sickly looking thing. And today we see him like he is. There was a time when we used to drool in the mouth over white people. We thought they were pretty because we were blind. We were dumb. We couldn't see them as they are. But since the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has come and taught us the religion of Islam, which has cleaned us up and made us so we can see for ourselves, now we can see that old pale thing to look exactly as he looked. Nothing but an old pale thing.
On December 1st, 1963, at a public rally in New York City, when asked what he thought of President Kennedy's assassination, Malcolm called it a case of, quote, the chickens coming home to roost, which was construed generally as meaning he was happy Kennedy was dead. 2 days later, the press reported a 90-day suspension of Malcolm X by Elijah Muhammad for the comment.
Malcolm, is there really a split between yourself and your former leader, Muhammad?
No, I wouldn't call it a split. Everything I know, I was taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Whatever I speak, I'm speaking that which he has taught me. Mm-hmm. And whatever position I've attained as a Muslim, I've attained it through his guidance and through his help. But during the 90 days that I've been silent, I have come to the conclusion that I can best help spread the solution that and the diagnosis that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gives of the so-called Negro problem in this country by continuing to remain out of the Nation of Islam and working on my own without restriction in the way that I think I best know how.
In mid-December 1963, the suspension of Malcolm X was extended indefinitely.
On March 12, 1964, after 10 years with the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X called a press conference announcing his break with the organization and the formation of a new group, the Muslim Mosque, which became the religious body and later the Organization of Afro-American Unity, the political body which leaned toward black nationalism.
That we will do everything within our power to bring about the complete control, political control, of Negroes over their own community, over the politics of their own community. And our economic philosophy, which is also black nationalism, is designed to show Negroes the importance of controlling their own economy. When Negroes are re-educated into the knowledge of how to set up businesses and establish factories, they can create their own employment, and then they won't be running downtown trying to boycott the white man or sit in at the white man's door or force him to give them a job. We want to try and show the Negro with the economic philosophy of black nationalism that he can house himself, clothe himself, feed himself, and do something for himself. And the social philosophy of black nationalism is to teach, again, it involves the re-education of Negroes. I hope I'm not talking too fast for you, but I can't help it. The social philosophy of black nationalism is to show the Negro how to take some pride in his own society, how instead of trying to force himself into the white society, how to elevate his own society and get some racial pride, racial dignity, so that he'll be socially acceptable to himself in his own society, and then perhaps he can get along better with other people in other societies. Make the city or state or government which takes our tax dollars channel some of these dollars right back into the Negro community and establish better schools in the Negro community with better teachers, with better curriculum. And one of the most important ingredients in that curriculum must be the culture, the lost culture of the Negro. So some effort must be made to restore the cultural roots of the Negro in the school system where Negroes attend.
You seem to have had a change of heart in your attitude toward Negro leaders in the civil rights movement. What position are you taking now?
Well, I think that the problem itself is so big that all of the so-called Negro leaders should try some way to forget our differences. I'm willing to forget anything that any Negro leader has ever said bad about me. And as I said earlier, I am praying that they will also be able to forget the many bad things that I've said about them, so we can sit down and try and find some common approach that can be used to solve this problem that's of common and mutual benefit to all of us.
After his break with the Muslims, Malcolm broadened his scope to include the international scene, and it was at this point that his life was threatened. In April 1964, Malcolm made a pilgrimage to Mecca. Here, at 39 years old, he received the name El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, the honorary Hajj being given to all who visit that Muslim holy city. From Mecca, he journeyed to Nigeria, Ghana, Morocco, and Algeria, finally returning to the United States, May 21, 1964. Malcolm wanted to galvanize public opinion against the United States for its oppression of black Americans and to get African support in bringing the American racial question before the United Nations. To do this, he needed the support of independent African states. And so in the summer of 1964, Malcolm returned to Africa for a four-month tour of 14 countries. In his autobiography, Malcolm notes that he was followed throughout Africa by persons from an unknown source. One of them was described as, quote, a thin-lipped, olive-skinned man.
On July 23, 1964, Malcolm was in Cairo, Egypt, to deliver a scathing attack of Washington's domestic and foreign policies in an address before the African Summit Conference, when he collapsed in his hotel room with severe abdominal pains. According to Eric Norden, in an article, The Murder of Malcolm X, Malcolm was rushed to a Cairo hospital, suffering from toxic poisoning, and had to have his stomach pumped. Malcolm later said he had been deliberately poisoned. Throughout the fall of 1964, Malcolm worked primarily on his plan to indict America in the United Nations. According to Eric Norden's information, Malcolm had been under surveillance since he broke with the Muslims, but now there were as many as, quote, three different agents shadowing him at one time.
In early February 1965, Malcolm flew to London to address the Council of African Organizations. From there, he was scheduled to fly to Paris to deliver another speech. However, on February 9th, when his plane landed in France, he was told by agents of the French government not to deplane, and he was ordered to leave the country immediately. Later, Malcolm was to say, according to Eric Norden, after an interview with Malcolm's sister, that his being barred from France led him to believe that the plotters of his death were much bigger than the Muslims.
On Saturday, February 12th, Malcolm returned to the United States by route of London. 10 hours later, at 2:45 Sunday morning, the home in which Malcolm, his wife Betty Shabazz, and their four children lived was firebombed. The house was severely damaged, although Malcolm and his family amazingly escaped unharmed. In an article entitled, The Last Days of Malcolm X, Earl Grant said, quote, evidently, there were several degenerate persons involved in this cowardly attack. The one in the rear had lost control of his flaming bottle and dropped it. Had this bottle been thrown into the house, Malcolm and his family would have been trapped.
On February 20th, he called a business meeting of his new group, the Organization of Afro-American Unity. That night, Malcolm stayed alone in a 12th floor room at the New York Hilton Hotel on 53rd Street and 6th Avenue. His family had been put up by friends in Queens, New York. A man later identified as Thomas Hagen, one of Malcolm's assassins, would be identified by a Hilton Hotel house detective as one of three black men asking questions about the location of Malcolm's room the night before his death.
The next morning, Sunday, February 21st, the day of his murder, Malcolm left his 12th floor hotel room, got into his blue Oldsmobile, and finally parked his car a number of blocks from the Audubon Ballroom, where his organization's meeting was to take place. He entered the main ballroom about 2:30 p.m. Shortly after 3 p.m., approximately 400 people had crowded into the ballroom, sitting on folding wooden chairs. One of Malcolm's aides introduced him.
The New York Herald Tribune, February 22, 1965, reconstructed what happened from eyewitness accounts. The applause stopped, and the people sat down, and Malcolm's goateed face looked up and he said, "Assalamu alaikum." And the crowd murmured its response of, "Peace be with you also." And then the two leadoff men made their move. They were in a middle row, and they stood up and started pushing each other. And one of them was saying, "Get your hands out of my pocket. Stop messing with my pocket." Malcolm's bodyguards started to move towards them to break it up. And up on the stage, Malcolm stepped out from behind the lectern, and he was saying, "Now, brother, break it up. Let's cool it." He stood there, alone on the stage, with one hand up in the air, and he was a perfect target. And a man, police say he was Thomas Hagen, ran down the aisle with a shotgun, and the ones with him were already shooting, when the shotgun was right in front of Malcolm X, and both barrels raked him. Malcolm went straight back, and the sound of his head slamming onto the wooden floor was mixed with the screams, and he lay on his back on the stage of an old ballroom. Peter Bailey, an associate editor of Ebony Magazine, was a member of the OAAU and worked closely with Malcolm X. He was at the Audubon the day of the shooting. That same day, he wrote his immediate reactions to what took place.
"I was in the rear of the ballroom, sitting and waiting at the entrance for the speakers who were expected. After hearing four shots, I ran into the main ballroom, looked up front, and saw nothing but confusion. The place sounded like a battlefield. I then dashed back out with a group of people running towards me and ducked into the bathroom at the side to avoid the shots. Immediately after hearing the last shot, I ran out of the bathroom and down the center of the totally wrecked hall to the stage. Jumping onto the stage, I saw Brother Malcolm's lying on the stage floor with bullet holes all over his chest. I leaned over him and saw that his skin was already getting that deathly look. There were several people administering to him when I got to the stage. I went into the room where others were holding his wife. I said that someone had gone for the doctor, not knowing whether this was true or not. I then jumped from the stage and started to the rear of the hall to see if the doctor was on the way. It was almost three quarters of the way down the hall that I saw the first two cops that I had seen, and those two were just casually walking through the hall as though they were on a Sunday stroll. This despite the fact that people were still screaming, crying, and the place looked like a battlefield."
Several questions arise from press accounts of what happened that day. In all three New York morning papers, descriptions were given of the capture of two suspects at the Audubon Ballroom immediately after the murder. In later editions of the same papers, and from then on, only one suspect was said to have been captured at the scene by police. And the press never questioned this.
An early edition of the New York Times, dated February 22, 1965, in an article headlined, "Malcolm X Shot to Death at Rally Here," said, quote, "The police indicated two suspects were being questioned," end quote. One of those suspects was identified as Thomas Hagen. In a later paragraph, the capture of the second suspect was described, quote, Patrolman Thomas Hoy, 22, said he had been stationed outside the 166th Street entrance when, quote, I heard the shooting and the place exploded. He rushed in, saw Malcolm lying on the stage, and, quote, grabbed a suspect who he said some people were chasing. As I brought him to the front of the ballroom, the crowd began beating me and the suspect, Patrolman Hoy said. He said he put this man, not otherwise identified later for newsmen, into a police car to be taken to the Wadsworth Avenue station. A late city edition of the same paper only indicated one person, Thomas Hagen, was captured at the scene. There is no further mention of a second suspect from then on.
All early edition February 22nd newspapers were actually on the newsstands the night of February 21st, which is the date of the assassination. In the February 22nd early edition of the New York Daily News, the same thing happened. Quote, two men, one the reputed assassin, were taken by police from the hands of a howling mob of Malcolm's followers. Both men were spirited away by the police. Again, later editions made no further mention of a second man.
Because of the mystery surrounding the second suspect, several independent writers and lesser-known publications have wondered if he could have been a police agent, and several other questions follow. What was the other man arrested by Patrolman Hoy doing to make the crowd think him a suspect? The police never explained why they didn't release this suspect's name as they did with Thomas Hagen's. He was described by eyewitnesses at the Audubon Ballroom as a, quote, tight-lipped, olive-skinned man with slanted eyes. The same description was used by Malcolm for a man he said followed him throughout Africa and Europe. One of the most curious aspects of the events surrounding Malcolm's assassination has to do with Gene Roberts, an undercover policeman who infiltrated Malcolm's organization. Shown here administering mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to Malcolm as he lay on the Audubon stage. The Muslims claim Roberts had defected from them with Malcolm the year before. He finally surfaced as an undercover police agent at the New York trial of the Panther 13. According to the New York Times of December 8, 1970, Roberts was assigned to undercover work when he became a policeman in 1965, the year that Malcolm was killed, and did not reveal himself until his Panther 13 grand jury testimony on April 1, 1969. The Times says, quote, Detective Gene Roberts said he had been assigned to infiltrate the organization of Malcolm X and was on duty as the black leader's bodyguard the afternoon he was killed on the stage. It is a frequent practice of white journalism for the press to convict blacks suspected or charged with crimes. Nowhere is the example of this practice more blatant than in the case of Malcolm's death.
Immediately after the assassination, both the police and press were quick to blame the Muslims for the assassination of Malcolm X. A quote from Time magazine, March 5, 1965. Malcolm's murder, almost certainly at the hands of the black Muslims from whom he had defected, came on a bright Sunday afternoon. The New York Times of February 22, 1965, in an article by Peter Kish said, quote, about 2 hours later, the police said the shooting had apparently been the result of a feud between followers of Malcolm and members of the extremist group he broke up with last year, the Black Muslims.
Besides Thomas Hagen, the one suspect police admitted holding, two others were later arrested, Norman Butler on February 26th and Thomas Johnson on March 3rd, 1965. Both Butler and Johnson were well-known Muslims who were out on bail on an assault charge at the time of Malcolm's murder. Neither was arrested at the scene. During the last days of the trial, the other suspect, Thomas Hagen, confessed to murdering Malcolm X, but said it was others, not Butler and Johnson, who aided him in the assassination. All three were subsequently found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. The court transcript of the trial reads, Thomas Hagen.
I know that they, Butler and Johnson, didn't have anything to do with the crime that was committed at the Audubon Ballroom February 21st, that I did take part in it, and that I know for a fact that they weren't there, and that I wanted to tell this to the jury, this to be known to the jury, the court, and the judge. I want to tell the truth.
Assistant District Attorney Dermody.
Will you tell us what the plan was, how the assassination was to take place?
Hagen.
Four people, two people sitting in the front row, man with the shotgun, short dark man with the beard sitting around the fourth row from the front. man in the back. One man starts commotion, says, "Get your hand out of my pocket." Guards from the stage goes after this man. Man with the shotgun shoots Malcolm. Two men on the front row shoot pistols.
D.A.
And which of these men were you?
Hagen.
One of the men sitting on the front row.
Later in the court transcript, D.A.
Do you know the names of these four people?
Hagen.
I do.
D.A.
Give us the names of these four people that you say you know were involved with you.
Hagen.
I will not.
D.A.
You testified a few moments ago that you were told to do this by somebody. Is that right?
Hagen.
I was offered some money for doing it from people that probably would have been revealed if Mr. Williams,
one of the defense attorneys,
could have continued his interrogation.
D.A.
I ask that that be stricken as not responsive.
The judge.
Strike it out. Although Hagen testified that three others than himself were involved, only two others than himself were convicted, neither of whom was involved in the murder, according to Hagen. According to the court transcript, no further efforts were made in the trial by the defense attorneys or the prosecution to discover the identity of the person or persons who hired Hagen and his confederates. Who actually ordered the killing of Malcolm? There has been much speculation. Although two of the men convicted of Malcolm's death were Muslims, and one, Thomas Hagen, rumored to be a Muslim, there has never been any formal evidence that his death was an official plot of the Nation of Islam, nor that these men convicted were acting under orders of black Muslim officials. The New York Times, dated February 23, 1965, reported that Elijah Muhammad denied that the black Muslim movement had anything to do with the slaying of Malcolm X. James Farmer, former director of CORE, felt Malcolm X was killed because of his crusade against drugs. Author Eric Norden notes that if the Muslims had their reasons for wanting Malcolm dead, so did others. Novelist Jay Kennedy also said it was because of drugs, but specifically named Red China as the force behind the assassin. Malcolm's sister, Ella Collins, said that his death was planned even before he was refused entry into France by the Western power structure. It has been 7 years since the assassination of El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, but there are still numerous questions left unanswered and many ends left dangling.
Hey, I am holding myself up. this love that I borrowed, I'll send back some time. Hey, 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 I am holding myself up on a fortress of feelings and the tire ropes of trust. Hey, hey, but it is not as I planned. The highway's my headboard, everything's made out of sand. Hey!
How was that one?
All right, feels good.
Thank you.